to another episode of the Sawdust and Fire Podcast. We are your hosts. I am Hunter Johnson.
And I'm Thomas Baldridge.
Brood habitat. Boy, Thomas, that seems to be a hot topic these days, and I am super excited that the word's getting out.
Oh, yeah. Very important where it comes to turkeys and quail. And, you know, the other component people probably overlook is that same type of habitat sure can make a deer happy.
Oh, you ain't kidding, man. We're seeing just our deer antler size is just growing by leaps and bounds, and we're holding more mature bucks and fawn recruitment's up. And but even better than that is the huge impact that we're having on turkeys and the coveys of quail that we've brought back from, I don't know, I guess they fell out of the air, grew out of the ground. They was almost non-existent. And then it's getting pretty impressive. And man, this is something I'm fired up about. Of course, this time of year, man, I love habitat season. For me, February 1st, duck season's over. That's day one of habitat season. And we are in full swing right now, going as hard as we can go. And I'm just, man, it's so exciting to me.
Well, and as always, the weather is not being our friend.
No. And,
but it is what it is. You play the hand you're dealt. I wish I could control the weather, but I can't. I'd probably mess it up if I could. You know, if I could control it, I'd probably goof it up. But yeah, man, you know, I was thinking today, I was riding, checking some fire lines and looking at some fire. And I was like, you know, I probably, without a doubt, at this point in my life, spend more time working on developing habitat than I do hunting.
Oh, I 100%. But I mean, to me, I enjoy it more than hunting.
I don't know if I enjoy it more, but it's definitely equal for me.
Right. And I was that way for a long time, and anymore, man, I just enjoy, I mean, habitat season, February 1st to basically here, it's about October 1st. Man, I am just fired up. I love it. We're creating a habitat that whole time. Now, October 1st, we start kind of shifting gears and getting ready for hunting season. But we're still, you know, hanging tree stands and doing a lot of stuff that people call habitat work. But, I mean, we're doing heavy-duty habitat work February 1st till October 1st. But yeah. You had a – you burned today, didn't you?
A little.
How'd that go?
Well, kind of like every burn you've ever been on, parts of it go real good and parts of it not so good. Kind of went in reverse today, and we've had an abnormal amount of rain, so that's kind of, you know, hindering things. But, you know, 'tis the season, so humidity was right, had some sunshine, was cooler than I really wanted it to be, but whatever. But I burned a pretty steep little south slope that I've got is what I started on. And I was really surprised that it did not burn as well. It had a southeast wind pretty much. And sometimes it seemed more east and sometimes more south. But anyhow, primarily a southeast wind. And I thought that south slope would just cook. And it, I guess, just had too much moisture there. But I mean, it burned okay. It's a really good, you know, mosaic habitat type deal right now. So I'm really pleased with it. In one area, it really did well, but in another area, it didn't do as good. But that's just the way it goes. And you know, another thing that I've learned, I used to would take a walk to where it didn't burn as well. Maybe it left me a spot the size of your living room or whatever it left. And I would try to make that burn, just come heck or high water. I would try my best. And I have learned now to leave it.
Yes.
Just let it be, man, because it's better representative of what naturally occurred in nature.
Yep.
And you don't know what's going to sprout or not sprout there. And then the other thing, I've come back a year later in those areas that weren't good at carrying a fire, and I tried to force a fire to go through them, and burned them the next year, just kind of like you did, and it just rocked perfectly. Yes. So sometimes, you know, we try to make things our way too much. And with that thought, I have to say this, because like you said, the brood habitat stuff has been a hot topic, and Dr. Lashley and they've really been, and Dr. Goolsby and even the Land and Legacy guys, I mean, everybody's had them on as of late, and they've really been talking about a lot of cool stuff. And, typically people want to get in one side or the other, which I don't really comprehend why there's, you know, the North and the South civil war, it seems like, in habitat with either predator management. And when you talk predator management, that camp only views predator management as trapping. And there's a lot more to predator management than that. And then you got the other camp that's solely, you know, pounding the pulpit on habitat. And it seems like those guys can't find common ground. I've been guilty of it myself. But, you know, the Atlanta Legacy guys had them on the other day, and, and they've really been trying to extrapolate some of the research and put that down to us. But one thing that we do know is that, that brood habitat is lacking on the landscape. And there's probably good reason for that. But it shows up in quail and turkey. I mean, it shows up in quail and turkey. They have to have it to survive.
They got to. And you're right. You know, that's been a big debate for a long time, but I think that debate's kind of coming to an end. I mean, you know, you can argue all you want about ways to control predators. I don't care. That's not even a point anymore. The point we're at now is that several different studies, and basically what every biologist, turkey biologist, every researcher in almost every state is screaming is, we can't find brood habitat. We can't find nesting habitat. And the studies are showing this over vast areas. There's just no brood habitat on the landscape. So doesn't matter what you want to, you know, you're right. There's a lot of ways to manage predators, and trapping is just one of them and a very small part of it. But there is a lot of opportunity to make a huge impact with brood habitat, and I think that's where we're at. I mean, it's almost like duck hunters in Arkansas. You know, you an Arkansas boy, you turn 16 years old, if you ain't got your own decoys and a boat, you're a punk. And yeah. That's about the way it is now. If you own land and you ain't managing for turkeys, you a punk.
Yeah.
It's great to see.
Yeah. Well, you know, kind of back on that same line of thought, brood habitat is really stuff that for the average person has been culturally trained that aesthetically it is unpleasing to the eye for the most part. It doesn't look manicured. We haven't put our fingerprint on it. You know, it's not well-groomed areas. And a lot of times, you know, we have this picturesque thought process, kind of like I was talking about, trying to make that one isolated spot to burn. You can get it to burn, but sometimes, you know, man's ways are not the best sometimes. And I'll tell you what really made the impact for me was really time with Ryan Diener, for one. And then the other was, getting exposed to some historical stuff that he shared with me and reading some books and historical early explorers journals. And so here's my deal. And I understand that there's arguments to come out of this, but pre-white settlement, all right, we had predators and we had prey, and everybody was living happy. And turkeys were thriving. In Schoolcraft's journal, they talk about one day they're you know, traveling, and they needed something for supper, and so they sent one or two of the guys out, and they shot 16 turkeys. I mean, that's a big supper. You know, I don't know what these guys, how hungry they were. But the turkeys and the quail, the buffalo, the deer, all these things were so, I mean, just flourishing, and the predators were doing okay too.
Right.
And then we manipulated habitat thinking that we had to, you know, improve it, whether that was, you know, fragmentation and, you know, a new subdivision went up in your best quail hunting field, or rather that was, you know, we came back from World War II and saw some things over there and thought we needed to clean up all these fence rows, or we got really economical driven and thought, well, if we clear this plot of ground and go ahead and plant those extra acres, you know, we'll be more profitable in our row crop. You know, we change things, and subsequently predators have done better in some cases than our prey have. So to me, it's kind of common sense, but
that not to interrupt you, but to make a point there on what you just said, Matt and Adam had a podcast that this was summed up pretty well. To do nothing for turkeys or building a Dollar General store on that pad, on that area, both have the same effect.
Yep, that's right.
So, you know, the plant communities around you are changing for the worse every day.
Hey, and right now, the privet, the Chinese privet, and the Bradford pears are rocking. And if you can't drive and see a white bloomed out tree scattered everywhere, that is the result of not doing anything and letting that stuff take over.
Absolutely. So are eastern red cedars. So are our little sweet gum thickets. I mean, it's all this crap is growing in places that it shouldn't be, whether it's native or non-native, whether it's invasive or aggressive. It's all there because you're not doing your job.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I think if we would think more holistically or ecologically, you know, I was talking to Ryan Diener. Unfortunately, we're losing him out of the state of Arkansas, and I wish him all the best. I mean, that dude's been awesome. He's been a tremendous asset in the state of Arkansas, and I hate we're losing him. But
he's not been just a tremendous asset. Probably not only while he was here, but even after he's gone, the people he's trained under him, he will forever be one of the best things that ever happened to wildlife in the state of Arkansas.
Oh, there's no doubt. I don't think he'll ever get the recognition, but they ought to name you know, they got this deal where they name wildlife management areas after people all the time nowadays, but man, they ought to name something after him for sure.
Well, for those that don't know, Ryan Diener is a brilliant man on habitat. He was, for the last several years, he has been our state Quail Forever, state coordinator for Quail Forever. And, you know, the people that he's trained under him are just phenomenal people, some of the most knowledgeable folks in the business. And Ryan himself, I don't know if he sent them all to boot camp or what he done, but it's just, I don't know about other states, but I know here in Arkansas, because of him, they have been a phenomenal organization. I'm going to hate to see him go, but I've got his phone number, and you can bet I'm going to be burning that up, because I don't care what state he lives in. He's going to be continuing to give me some advice.
Well, absolutely. And he told me, by all means, he said that, you know, that number you and I have is his personal cell. He said, keep it. And he also said he would love to get on the podcast and talk habitat. So I'm excited about that, because, man, he has a great way of explaining things, and it makes perfect sense. But what I was going to tell you is, you know, we talk about ecological stuff, and man, I ain't even sure. I'm such a dumb old country boy. I don't even know really what the full meaning of all that is. Had to look up ask Siri or look up a definition. But here's the deal. He told me when he was hiring people, even if they, you know, if they came out of Russellville Tech or University of Arkansas Monticello, or even if they came out of Dr. Goolsby or Dr. Lashley at Florida and Auburn, or they came out of MSU Deer Lab. He said he tried to find, and man, I don't even know if it's politically correct anymore, but he tried to find the nerdy kids. He said the nerdy kids that were studying flowers in their off time. He said the ones that look like a deer hunter that you see in every gas station and every Walmart and every hunting store in the state of Arkansas. He said those are not the ones that I tried to hire.
Well, you don't get the basketball player to help you with your homework.
That's right. That's right. And once he hired them, he was very good about mentoring them and training them and developing them and helping them. And anyways, I guess enough about that. But what he told me was the difference in the biologist is this. You have one that is your typical deer hunter. And that's the lens he looks at things through. And then you have others who are more ecologically minded. And he said, those are the ones that he tried to hire and develop because it is just a difference in mindset. Could have sat through the same classes and got the same degree, even at the same, institution and just turn out to view things differently. I think when we view things in a more ecological manner, like we don't have to annihilate every predator. I mean, there are certain things that are prey. I mean, you and I are predators. You know, we like to hunt and kill things and eat them.
Definitely.
I mean, so we don't have to eliminate all predators. We need to look at things more holistically or ecologically when we're doing habitat. But
well, we see that every day. I mean, you know, look at the Wild Turkey Science podcast right now. The people that are listening to it, there's folks interpreting it a lot of different ways. I mean, and there's some folks that they're never going to get it ever. No. So, yeah, I mean, that's just the way it works, unfortunately.
Yep, that's right. Well, hey, so you and I have got some burns in. You've been planting some native pollinator mixes and little clover, maybe a little wheat. And you have, within the past year or so, maybe longer, but you've acquired two new gadgets that I definitely want you to talk about. And one is the seeder that you're using on your side by side. And two is your T-jet, which you have to explain to everybody what that is and how, I mean, that's an expensive thing to purchase, may not be useful to every landowner, but explain to them how, what it is and how that very simply, I mean, you ought to be able to figure this out real simple, but how it's even going to save you money.
Well, so the thing you're referring to, the T-Jet, it's a GPS monitor. It's made by T-Jet, and I don't even remember the number on it now, but they don't make – oh, yeah, here's a paper on it. It is a – here's where I ordered it. It's called a Matrix 430. Now, I've used these before when I worked for Game and Fish. We had two or three of them, and they were bigger screens, and I was kind of disappointed when I unboxed this one and saw – how small the screen is. It's not much bigger than my cell phone, but it's got, you can actually see it better than the bigger ones that we had with Game and Fish. It's just got a brighter display. Even when the sun's hitting it, you can still read it well. We'd take plastic Game and Fish signs and bend them and tape them together and make a sunscreen around those that we had on our four-wheelers for Game and Fish, but this one here, I haven't needed anything. So I've got a Honda Pioneer and I mounted this thing. It's got a little RAM mount, 1-inch ball RAM mount, and I mounted it on the dash right above the steering wheel. So when I'm looking straight ahead, I can see this thing. And I can also, I've mounted my seeder on the front, and it's got a yellow box and I can see through the box to know how much seed I've got in it. So I'm seeing everything that's happening, watching my broadcast pattern At the same time, I'm looking at the monitor and looking ahead of me, and it's just amazing how efficient you can be with the right equipment. So I can use this T-Jet monitor for spraying, for putting out fertilizer, for broadcasting seed, whether I'm planting food plots or I'm planting fluffy native seed, and it's going surprisingly well. So you can set up this monitor. It tells you how fast you're going. It shows you where you've been. It tells you if you need to go left or right to get back on track. If you're overlapping, it shows where you've overlapped in red. So, you know, let's just take, for instance, $400 an acre pollinator mix seed that you're putting out. If you're overlapping or skipping spots or whatever, that can cost you a lot of money. You go all the way, say, let's say you're going to do 40 acres of it in a bunch of little blocks, and you're overlapping a bunch, then you're either not going to have enough seed to finish, or you're just wasting money putting out more than you need to. Or if you're skipping spots or whatever, same way with herbicide, you know, even glyphosate right now is well over $100 a jug, 2.5 gallon jug. So, oh, yeah. You know, and yeah. Some of the stuff we use, especially when we're spraying army worms and stuff, some of that's $300 a gallon. And, you know, I think this monitor, I paid full retail for it. I think it was around $1,400. Now I did buy an upgraded antenna instead of the little hockey puck. I've got a bigger antenna, but I got to be careful because tree limb hits it just right. I'll bust it or knock it off there. But it just magnets on the top. It's got a little steel plate you screw down to your roof, stick this thing on the top. It's got a power cord, plugs in a cigarette lighter, and you're up and running, and you can see your speed. You can set your width. So if you say today I'm slinging native seed and it's only slinging at 12 foot, but then I switch over to wheat and I'm slinging at 25 foot because it's heavier and slings further, I can adjust that. Same way, I've got like four different spray booms, a 65-gallon tank I can put in the back of my side-by-side, and like four different spray booms, so I can adjust the width, and it paints a blue line everywhere I've been. And tells me when I've overlapped, tells me when I've skipped spots, tells me if I need to go a half a foot to the right or left, or 4 foot to the right or left, or whatever you need to do. If you want to lay a line here and then you can't make your turn at the end because you're narrow or something and you can't turn sharp enough, you can skip over, and it tells you, you know, you could skip over 50 foot or 100 foot or quarter mile, and it keeps you on the same plane with the same distance, so you're not overlapping when you come back and fill in the middles. So really, really cool how it works. And
that comes in handy at lunchtime for break,
I guarantee you. And you know, so let's say you're going through the field and all of a sudden you run out of seed or you run out of chemical,
which happens all the time.
Every time you do it and you want to come back to it, you just hit a button and it marks that spot in the middle of a field. And you may have some of these fields, you know, everybody says, well, I can see my tracks where I've ran. Well, these fields, I've done been over them spraying. I've done been over them seeding two different times, two different directions. I've got tracks everywhere. So when I run out, all I have to do is hit a button. I can take off to the truck. I can come back in 10 minutes, I can come back in 2 weeks, and it takes me back to that same exact spot where I ran out, and I can just start in right there, and it tells me everything that I've been over. And it's just a phenomenal tool. You know, fertilizer prices are high, seed prices are high, herbicide prices are high, insecticide prices, and it's just going to save time and save money. And that's something that I need both of. I need to save time and money both on everything I do.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, just knowing where I've been and being able to change the line I'm painting, depending on if I'm spraying or seeding or whatever, know where I've overlapped or where I've missed spots and that kind of a deal. I mean, that to me is just so cool, man. It's, and that screen, you say it's small, but it's as big as a pretty good size iPhone, and it's really clear and bright. And I was pretty impressed with it, really.
I've got a video of it that I can share that I'll put on the Land and Legacy podcast page, video of it working. Same one I sent you the other day. But
yeah.
And you know, I've still got some learning to do about it. I'm discovering something new about every time I use it.
Tell them about, like, just driving a field edge and, you know, calculating that. Or if you wanted to map out roads, or you wanted to you know, do a east to west road that's a quarter of a mile, and then step over a half a mile in the field and parallel that road exactly. That thing can do it all.
It can. So yeah, it's got a feature on there. You can hit a button and you can just circle a field and it will tell you how many acres is in the field. You can, like you were saying, you know, I've got some roads and levees to build, and say I want to build a road here, and I know how to build this road, you know, to be kind of square. Let's say, you know, so out here at the house, I've got a driveway that comes in, and I've got a gravel road on one side, and I want to put up a couple of levees this summer with tractor and dirt scoops, and I want to put them up parallel and square with the world. And, you know, when you're talking about a mile-long levee or a half-a-mile-long levee, you can get it straight from point A to point B. But are you square with the road that's a half a mile or a mile down there away from you? You want to be parallel to that. And the reason why is, you know, from the air, it just looks better. And then when you're planting, you've got a square field. So, you know, your disc marks or your planter marks, you don't have point rows if you're planting or whatever. So you can put in an AB line and drive the road, and then you can go a half a mile or a mile across the field away from it and put and drive that same plane and know that you're parallel. And not only that, but you could set in, let's say my planter is 12 foot wide, and I want to make sure that I've got an even number of rows from this levee to this levee, so I don't get to the end and like, well, I've got room for four more, but not six more or whatever. I got room for two more rows, but not four more rows. Well, I can set those and be the same distance so that when I plant along the edge of this road, when I get to the other side, then I'm still, I have four full rows that I can plant there. Or if I want to do a, say I want to do a 20 foot native pollinator buffer strip around everything, then my rows still work out perfect inside that. So it's just a really cool, really cool deal. And, then this cedar, man, this cedar is phenomenal. You mentioned it. And I've used a herd cedar for years, and I thought that was the best you could get, but it had a lot of flaws. I was burning up motors. Now, y'all keep in mind, I manage about 5,000 acres, and I have about 300 acres of open land, and I've got a lot of planting, a lot of spraying, a lot of fertilizer, a lot of seeding. There's a lot of stuff I do. And I do the majority of that off of a side-by-side. I mean, I use it every day. This thing's like 4 years old, and I've got over 12,000 miles on it. So I go through a lot of cedars, and a $200 cedar just wasn't working for me. So I stepped up to a herd cedar, and I think it was $900 or $1,000, and I was burning up motors. Motors were $250 a piece. You got to wait for one to be shipped. You got to pay shipping on it. It's a nightmare to replace a motor in it. It takes most of half a day or so, and you can't see what you're doing back there. The hitch in the receiver was dragging the ground on uneven terrain. And the one I've got now is an APV, and I built a bracket and mounted it on the front of my Honda Pioneer. And it's got a control box in the cab, so I can open and shut the gate electronically by pushing a button, and I can control my width, how far I sling seed. And it's got an adjustment on the front, and you can sling anything from little bitty teeny seeds like clover seeds all the way up to, man, I've slung soybeans with it and corn and, man, I don't know what all. But you can sling some big seeds out of it. And, you know, I can put out, last year I planted 20 acres of soybeans with it and put out a bag of soybeans per acre. And I done it with a planter and access to a drill because this is faster and easier. And I can just drive my side-by-side and I can be done with it before I could ever get the planter or drill adjusted and get out there and get it filled up and get started. So, man, I planted 20 acres of soybeans, planting a bushel per acre in no time flat. So I love it, man. I can't say enough. Now, you know, the cedar was pretty expensive. I think it was $1,400 or $1,500 and I paid full retail for it, but working by myself most of the time, I don't want to be working on stuff. When I've got a chance to go do something, I want to be able to go do it. And well, that's
and that brings me up to another point. I mean, in reality, even if you are a full-time land manager, you're fighting the weather. I mean, we're getting 4 days of rain and 2 or 3 days of sunshine. You know, yes. So, you know, I mean, it makes it hard. And sometimes your window of opportunity to get something done is narrow. And that's something else I wanted you to talk about is you manage another farm. How far is Tiger B from you? Hour and a half?
Yeah. If you're pulling a trailer with, anything, hauling equipment or even hauling a side by side, it's going to take you an hour and a half.
So that's a unique deal. And then of course the property that you live on, you manage it as well, but Tiger B's we'll say an hour and a half from you. And I think a lot of people can identify, you know, if they own or lease property, most of those people probably drive 45 minutes to 2 hours, I would guess,
yes,
to their farm, to their hunting place or whatever.
Right.
So there's been some things that you've done remotely as in, I hate to say an absentee landowner, but that's kind of what you are. You live in a different county. So let's talk about some of the struggles and then how you've overcome some of those. And I know this sounds really stupid to even probably say this, but even planting the native pollinator mixes that you're planting now, walk me through that, because the reason I asked that, let me clarify this, is there was a guy on the Land and Legacy page and he asked something about planting pollinators, and man, I feel horrible a lot of times when people ask a question, I answer it. It's hard to get a full message across on Facebook and mm-hmm. understanding. And I told him, I said, well, that's not the way I would have done it, but you'll be all right, kind of a deal. And he's like, well, how would you have done it? Well, in a pollinator planting, usually what I'm going to do is for at least a year, I'm going to spray it and kill it every time it greens up. If I'm converting a field, you know, from whatever it is, and I want it to be a pollinator mix, I'm going to, as soon as it greens up, I'm going to spray it. And then as soon as it, 2 months later, whatever decides to come back and grow again, once it greens up good, I'm going to spray it. Well, you bare minimum have to do that 3 to 4 times a year, bare minimum. And you have to be living there and watching it and seeing it to make that happen.
It's a year-long investment.
And yeah, before you plant your first seed.
That's right.
I mean, you got a chemical bill involved in this. And some people do that for 2 years of trying to terminate stuff. And then that's fine. But I do 1 year is what I have done. Then I like to try and burn it and then plant my seed in the winter or even late fall or early winter, where hopefully it's going to set on that soil. We got good bare dirt, seed contact, seed to soil contact, and then it's going to get frost, it's going to get snow, it's going to get ice, it's going to get rain, and it's going to naturally get down in the soil. Now, that's the way I like to do it. Some people like to drill it, some people like to do this, but the good Lord designed it where that seed can drift off of a, let's just say, a big blue stem, and it can float over on the ground, and that seed can get contact with the soil, the snow and ice can help get it on in there, and then it's going to grow. Right. So, but you ended up with some seed that was some leftover stuff. It sat in your shop for a while for a lot of different reasons. And then people wonder if it's any good anymore and all this stuff, which native seed, typically if it's even in nature, it can last a long time in the seed bank. But if it hadn't been, we'll say, harmed in some way, you know, that seed's pretty good. And even if it's not, you could increase your rate, or you could test it, see what germinates. But anyways, so being an absentee landowner in that case, you wound up taking that seed up there and planting it right now, which is the exact wrong time for me and my prescription that I would normally say do. But there's a method to the madness. And sometimes you have to think outside the box, and you have to work around your schedule, Mother Nature, availability of supplies and parts these days. There's a whole host of things that you have to navigate, and there's more than one way to skin a cat.
That's right. And, you know, being an absentee landowner, you know, you've got to, you know, really, you've got to think about what all am I going to need when I get up there? Am I going to get up there and find Johnson grass? Am I going to get up there and find army worms? Am I going to get up there and whatever? I mean, you can't imagine all the scenarios that you might get into. So you've got to take dang near everything you own with you, or you get up there and you don't have what you need. So prime example, my truck had been in the shop, and I took everything out of it, out of the cab, and locked my toolboxes that had all my tools, everything I need in it, locked it up, and took everything that was inside the cab out and took it to the shop. It was in the repair shop for over a week. I get it back and I'm excited, but I'm behind. My truck's been in the shop. It's been raining. Now the weather's pretty. I got crap to do. So my plan is I'm taking off to the hill farm. It's an hour and a half away, and I'm going to get up there and I'm going to spray, and I'm going to sling seed, and we're going to get some of this done. I threw everything I thought I needed in the truck. I loaded my sprayer in the back of the side by side. I tried it to make sure it was going to come on and run, make sure I didn't have to work on a motor or take a spare motor with me, pump with me. Loaded it on a trailer. Everything worked fine. I get up there. I fill it up with herbicide. I pull over to the water pump, fill it up with water. I get out there, get my GPS on, get my boom unfolded, get everything lined out, kick my sprayer on. I make one pass. When I get to the end, I flip the switch, shut my sprayer off, turned around to come back right beside where I'd just been. I kicked my pump on. It wouldn't work. Sprayer wouldn't spray. Well, crap. So I worked on it, monkeyed around, narrowed it down. It's a bad switch. Switch has gone bad. I put a switch in the dash and the switch has gone bad. No problem. I got spare switches in the truck. I'll just run up there, swap it out. Get up there. Guess what?
Wrong truck.
The keys to unlock my toolboxes aren't in the truck. They're laying on the desk in my office where I cleaned my truck out.
Hour and a half away.
I've got every tool I need. I've got a spare pump for a sprayer. I've got spare switches. I've got wires. I've got wire ends. I've got everything I could possibly need in them toolboxes, but I ain't got no keys to get in them. So I'm unhooking a trailer and I'm jumping in the truck and I'm driving 25 miles in the opposite direction to a Tractor Supply. And I go in Tractor Supply and I buy wire and I buy a power cord and I bought two switches. And I had to buy a wrench and a pair of pliers to get the dang switch out of the dash because I couldn't get to any tools. I didn't have nothing. So after buying that, I come back and I get it all changed out. Everything works great. I ended up having an awesome day. But like you're saying, it is, you know, because of stuff like that, I can't get everything done I need to get done the way it ought to be done. And I have preached for a long time, the best time to do something is when you have time to do it. You know, if you ain't had time to deer hunt And now you've got a chance to go and it's raining. Go deer hunting because you can't go tomorrow. The best time to everybody, well, the deer may not be moving. Well, you ain't going to know if you ain't out there. So, you know, same way with doing this habitat work, you know, people are not hacking squirting right now because they say, well, it's greening up and we got sap flowing, it won't kill the tree. Well, I got time to hack and squirt, and I don't want to do it when the ticks and chiggers and rattlesnakes are bad, and it's 100 degrees outside, because I've got other things I got to be doing then. Right now, I have time to do some hack and squirt, and the weather's nice. I'm going to hack and squirt. If I don't kill every tree I hack, so what? At least I got most of them. That's always been my attitude. Plus, if you do stuff a little unorthodox, you learn what works and what doesn't. Now you can better give advice to people when they ask questions. You know, if you only do it by the book, everybody knows what the book says.
So, and you get different results. And sometimes those different results turn out to be a huge success on accident.
That's right. That's right. So with that said, we done a timber thinning. I made a bunch of wildlife openings. This place is about 1,200 acres, and I had a total of maybe 10 acres of openings on the whole place. Well, now I've probably got close to 100 acres of openings. And the reason why is I made them on purpose when we done some timber thinning. It's a mosaic blocks of a big opening with a little pinch point that goes into a small opening, and then another one branches off to another small opening and goes into another bigger one. Smallest ones are maybe a half a tenth of an acre, and some of the bigger ones might be 3 acres, 4 acres at the most. So I wanted a series I wanted to plant some pollinator mixes, native seed mixes, and I wanted some clover spots, and I wanted some spots of wheat. Well, the ideal thing would have been to disc it all up real good, roll it all down, broadcast your seed, roll your seed in, do that in the fall or early winter, let it lay there all winter, blah, blah, blah. I ain't got time for all that. So this place had been, we brought in a dozer, we cleared all the stumps off of it. We drug it down after that and cleaned everything up, drug the chunks off of it, leveled it good. Fescue started coming back. And I don't want to wait another year to get this native seed out. So some of the fescue I burned and then seeded it. Some of it I've sprayed and then seeded it the next day or 2 days later. But it's raining every 2 or 3 days. We've got frost coming last weekend and again this coming weekend.
Well, and the pat this morning was frosty.
That's right. So I sprayed it, and then I come in the next day or 2 days later, and I am slinging native seed on top of it. And I figure birds, most of this crap that's growing is because birds are transporting it and dropping it. I can drop it just like a bird does. And I got this cedar slinging it out. I'm going heavier because it's more than a year old. It's 2-year-old seed, three-year-old seed maybe. So I'm going a little heavier rate. Plus, I'm slinging it into some thatch, and it's probably not all hitting the ground or making great seed-to-soil contact at the moment. It'll eventually work its way down. So I'm slinging a little heavier. And on top of all that, I'm prepared for failure. If it doesn't work, if I don't get what I want in the end, hey, I'm okay with that. I'm not going to beat myself up. I just learned what not to do anymore. But if I don't do something, it's not going to happen. And I don't want to invest another year. It's already been 3 years that we started this project to have something there. And because of whatever we still lacked and needed to do, we haven't got to plant any of this yet. And I know I don't have time to plant a perennial clover and get it to come up, but I'm slinging some annual and biennial clovers out on top of the ground. And hey, it'll come up or it won't. But if it doesn't, I'll be able to give great advice, and I will have learned a whole lot through this. But, you know, the best part of it is, I'm getting stuff done.
Well, so, it ain't going to grow in the bag.
That's right.
And the cool thing about natives is naturally they can lay in the soil or even on the ground for a long period of time before they're actually sprouting. So,
you know,
I think you'll see next spring, really next summer. I just my prediction, whatever it's worth. I think next summer you will see some cool stuff coming on.
Well, I think so. And, you know, I know I've sprayed enough fescue in my life that I know I didn't get all my fescue killed. But here's the deal. You know, in this part of the country, you're going to get grass coming up in things. You're going to get broom sedge. You're going to get some little blue stem. You're going to get things coming up. So I went light. These mixes are really light on grasses anyway. So I'm prepared to come back with a grass-specific herbicide and spray grasses if fescue comes up through it. I would rather it be all forbs anyway. But, you know, that's impossible because you're going to have broom sedge and little blue and different things pop up regardless, no matter whether it's in your mix or not, whether you spray, no matter how hard you spray, that stuff's going to come up anyway. So I'm not concerned about that. And if I need to come back and hit it every year for the next 3 years to help knock out more fescue, hey, I'm cool with that.
Yep. So, you know, sometimes when you are that absentee, you know, landowner, you're working at a distance, you have another job, maybe another property you're managing, or you're doing an 8-to-5 stint or you know, in an office or whatever, sometimes you got to play the cards you're dealt.
That's right.
And I'll tell you, I've got an area that we did a commercial timber harvest on this property, and there's about a 2-acre area that was cut really hard. And the first little response I got is primarily broom sedge, and it's taken me 2 or 3 years, but now I've got some greenbriars there and Lord knows what all else, a lot of broom sedge still. And I got a really good burn on it right now. Deer have started using it for bedding. And instead of trying to create another bedding area somewhere else, I'm trying to play the hand I was dealt. It's a good location. It's in a good location. I mean, I have no gripes about the location. And so all I'm trying to do is just enhance it, you know, and get it kind of where I want it for, you know, more thickety type stuff, and see if I can get some more good things growing there.
Right.
Sometimes playing the hand you're dealt is a lot. You come out so much further ahead in time and money than you do sometimes trying to make something happen.
That's right. I mean, you know, the best way to learn, I mean, now don't run out and do things that you just absolutely can't afford to fail on, but the best way to learn is just try stuff. I mean, you know, everything that's written in a textbook, somebody at some point done it and learned it, and then they've passed it on. That doesn't mean it's the only way to do it.
Right.
It might be the best way to do it, but sometimes what's best just doesn't work out, especially when you're a one-man show with more than you can get done. You know, the big topic right now is brood habitat, and I've been getting up early. I've been running up there. I'm either spraying until the humidity drops 1 o'clock or so, and then burning in the afternoons, or I'm slinging seed of a morning and burning in the afternoons. And I wasn't even going to burn yesterday, and Aaron hollered at me. Our buddy Aaron Osborne has been helping me quite a bit. And you know, everybody needs an MMA fighter to help burn with you. Oh, Aaron's an MMA fighter. So when you need somebody, he's into this workout stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So when you need somebody to, here, put on this backpack drip torch and take off down this hill and drop fire all the way down the edge of the creek so the fire can run uphill and
then
up the hill on the end, he's all about it, dude.
Yeah, for a half a mile or a mile, he's like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's all about it. And he ain't even out of breath. I mean, I'd be out of breath before I got to the bottom of the hill.
Yeah, and knees hurting and everything else. No, sir, he's like asking for more.
Oh yeah. Once he ain't got to go to the gym tonight. If you'll work him real hard, he ain't even got to go to the gym. So
yeah. Yeah.
So that's, so we've been burning, man. We got a, but he called and wanted to know, he called Monday and, asked if I wanted to burn Tuesday afternoon. I said, man, I don't think it will go, but I've been watching fire weather forecast and, the conditions are going to be right. It's just, we've had a big rain and things are wet. I guess it dried out a little bit more than I thought it did. Cause I probably Tuesday afternoon is just he and I burning. We probably burnt 40 acres maybe, in about three different little blocks. And I probably got the best burn that I've ever got. And it was on some of that stuff that we couldn't get to burn last year.
Yep.
But it burnt like a champ this year. I mean, 100% black across the entire area.
Yep.
Now, I would like to burn a whole lot more, but looking at this, I'm getting a lot of woody sprouts. My brambles are really heavy. Places my grasses are getting heavy, and I'm really needing a growing season burn to set some of that back. So I'm probably, after that burn yesterday, I'm probably going to stop, and then let's look at things again in August, September, and see if we can get in some growing season burns to set back some of these grasses, brambles, and brambles is the main thing. I got some woody encroachment, but the brambles are just, them sawbriar thickets you were talking about, my yeah. bird habitat's been taken over by some sawbriar thickets in a lot of places.
Well, the deer like them.
Well, the deer love them, but, you know, I don't know about that hen and them poults, and hey, it's, I'm 100% about brood habitat right now. That's the only thing on my mind.
Everybody's got that on the brain, and
yeah. So what's your plans? What do you got happening this spring? What's on your big list besides getting this burned? You still doing some timber restoration project?
Yep. And trying to do, I don't know what fancy words you want to call it, a historical ecological restoration on my timbered areas, which I'm really excited about. We've got some cool plans, and I'm hoping that we're able to get that done this year. The other thing I've got going on, a native grazing demonstration project, which is native warm season grasses and forbs and a few native cool season grasses. My son and I went Saturday and vaccinated some cattle and banded some, so they won't turn some bulls into some steers.
Yeah.
And getting ready now that you and I got that native warm season grass. Well, I shouldn't even call it that probably, but this native grazing area, now that you and I got it burned, once it greens up and starts flushing well, we're going to move those cattle in on them on that area. And we're gonna take weight measurements on them when we move them in, and probably monthly weight measurements on them to see what they're gaining, you know, each month, and then, you know, to collect all that data. We also talked about I don't even understand some of this stuff with biologist people. You know how they are, the nerdy folks. Talking about possibly taking some hair follicle samples off the cattle and sending that off for some kind of test. So that they just want to collect as much data off of this project as they can, which is really cool. And and then we're also doing some water infrastructure work there, where we're putting in some livestock tanks so we can do a little bit of rotational grazing over there. And the benefit to this, really, you know, it's not going to change my world at all. I mean, me and you at some point is going to eat a steak. That's all I know, because one of these cows, somebody's got to die. I mean, we got to eat a steak, you know.
I ain't been big on bringing that up, but you're going to have plenty of steak in the freezer. I'm getting some of that.
We got to have a steak, man. I'm just already, man, I'm dying to eat one. And last night I made fried deer meat. That all that DMAP work is coming into you know, play in the evenings. As my girls are younger, they call them deer nuggets. we were eating them deer nuggets last night, but I'm ready for a steak, you know. It ain't nothing like a steak, but anyhow, they're going to collect some really cool data off of this, and we're going to use the cattle as a management tool in helping our habitat, trying to basically somewhat mimic the buffalo disturbance. And, you know, that is going to help, you know, all the native warm season grasses, the cool seasons, and the forbs there. Then hopefully we're going to get a good insect response, and that's going to help, you know, the quail and the turkeys. And I mean, it's just, you know, kind of a good holistic looking deal there. Plus, we are going to be able to take that data and share it not only with the state, but beyond that. And hopefully, which we've already had one producer has a farm down in either Garland or Hot Spring County. He came up and looked at what we were doing, and, you know, it just started making sense to him, and he's enrolled in the program. So while we may only be converting, you know, small percentages on each farm, imagine this: if we're able to take ground that used to be in natives, and we, you know, us geniuses people put it in Bermuda or fescue or Bahia or whatever introduced grass you want to talk about, which is just death on quail and turkey poults. And we're able to convert a small percentage of that back to natives, and it benefits the cattle, it benefits the producer, and it benefits the wildlife. And we're able to show that in a research project. Now, it's already been done in other states. Don't get me wrong. Arkansas is just behind, which is common for Arkansas. But anyways, we're going to be able to share that with other producers in our state. We're going to have them where they can come and do site visits here and look and see what it looks like, and, you know, what we've been able to do, and, you know, kind of what we're doing here. And I'm not saying we're right. I'm not saying that we know everything, and, you know, but it's kind of like you said earlier, it works. And, there's probably some really good benefits. You know, even in the meat, you could probably make an argument, you know, if you were finishing them on natives, you could probably make an argument that that's even probably better for you. I don't know, but anyhow, there's a lot of reasons, economical reasons, and also, you know, ecological reasons and all this stuff. There's a lot of reasons to do some native grazing. So I'm really excited about that project. And, you know, we're already rocking and rolling on all of that. I mean, it's, we're just, I don't know, days or a month or, let's see, what is this, March 15th. So we're probably 30 to 45 days, depending on weather, from, you know, moving cattle in over there.
Well, that's good, you know, and that goes back to what we, you know, really what this whole podcast was about, is just, you know, don't be scared to try it. And, you know, this deal, everything screams that it ought to work, this native grazing project that you're doing. You know, but you're going through the steps, you're doing everything right. And, you know, if it works, I think there's going to be a lot of people take notice. I mean, crap, if you can raise cattle and not have to feed them, not have to fertilize pastures, not have to lime pastures, not have to plant that awful grass that everybody thinks you have to have. I mean, people made a living on it back before the 60s and 80s when fescue and Bermuda grass came on scene and got popular. You know, why can't you go back and do it now, especially with this weather we've been having and extremely wet winters and horribly dry summers, and, you know, people's pastures getting eaten up by army worms, and, you know, having to spend all the money fertilizing and then drought getting it and burning it up. And, you know, hey, we hope it works. We think it ought to work. But if it doesn't, you know, at least you're going to get your money back. Plus, you're going to get to eat good.
Well, you know, when I was looking at doing this, I was at a pivotal, whatever the heck it is. I was at a point where, you know, I needed to make a decision on what I was doing with that ground. And I was really stressed. I know I talked to you about it a lot because I was like, every time I would ask them, you know, is there anybody in the state doing this? And they're like, no. And I, why not? You know, sometimes it's cool to be the only one, but a lot of times it ain't wise to be the only one.
That's right.
And so I was like, why not? And they're like, well, we got a guy that, you know, he's incorporated some natives. And I was like, well, let me go look at his farm. So, man, I tore off over there and went and looked at his place. And now here's the deal. Missouri's way ahead of us. They are native grazing like crazy. Tennessee's ahead of us. Tennessee, University of Tennessee's got some awesome studies. Man, just a lot of cool stuff happening. I finally, you know, decided between you and my dad. My dad's like, well, if it don't work, we got a bunch of good habitat and we'll eat good for a little while. So yep. What have you lost? And, you know, for me, it was a perfect fit. It may not be for everybody, but for me, it was a perfect fit. And I'm really excited about the data that the other universities have already collected and the data that we're going to collect, because I feel like not only does the data is the data already exist to be able to prove this as being a success, but you know, everybody always thinks, well, that's not Arkansas or well, you know, it's different, you know, for whatever reason. Well, and then plus sometimes you have to see it. People sometimes have to see it. You can read about it. You can watch it on YouTube, but it's different when you walk in the field. And so we're going to give them that opportunity, you know, come look, walk in the field, pick you up a blade of grass, do whatever you need to do. And we're going to give them that opportunity and hopefully, you know, hopefully it's going to be a success. And our goal really is not only to get the data and share it with everybody, but our goal is to convince some current, you know, cattle producers that, hey, there is another way that's actually arguably better. And if we could, you know, just put part of your ground in that might turn into be some really good wildlife habitat as well, and it'll benefit our quails and turkey. I'm going to tell you what I learned this week. One of the main things I learned this week is if we are going to do anything to scale in habitat, I think there's three components. If you don't listen to any, I hope that the Game and Fish commissioners and everybody else listening to this, but one, it's going to have to occur on private land. Two, your resources, funding, and development is going to have to be as diverse as your habitat. And what I mean by that is, and this ain't an original thought, this is something I learned, that we are going to have to get assistance and partners with a lot of different people. There's not any one person or any one agency or any one entity that is going to be able to move the needle on this by themselves.
That's right.
And then the third thing we're going to have to do is incorporate working lands. Working lands for wildlife, you ought to check those guys out. They're doing things across the continental United States. It's pretty cool. But we have so much ag ground in every state. If we could convert some of that ground, and there's never, what did Dr. Lashley or Dr. Goolsby said that, I can't remember, one of the other guys told them they've never set foot on a piece of property, on a farm, row crop, cattle farm, whatever, that there was not an area of that farm that was costing them more to keep it in production than to take it out.
Oh, that's, yeah, 100%. That's right.
So we are going to have to get the working land stuff, and we're going to have to change our thought process on agriculture as far as, you know, producing, thinking we have to make every acre produce a number, even if it's costing us money. And we got to make those partnerships, and we got to get grants. We're going to have to get federal funding. We need all the suit and ties in the world to go rub shoulders with the powers that be to let people know that this impacts everything from butterflies to turkeys. And I ain't ate a butterfly. If you can fry them, I might be interested, but I have eaten some turkeys and I like it, and I want my quail back, and I want them all healthy. And ecologically, there's a holistic thing here that's good for the environment. And man, if we can do some of this stuff, then we're going to make headway, but we cannot do it alone. And I think some of the big federal or state agencies like Game and Fish or QF or maybe a nonprofit or whoever, there's no one group that can lift this deal alone. That's we're right. going to need everybody lifting, and we need everybody's money, you know, farm bill stuff and this and that, whatever it takes. We're going to need a lot. And then changing the way that we look at agriculture and ag ground. And if we can convert some of those acres, that's where we're going to see big gains. And that goes really for everything from hardwood restoration, GTRs, upland stuff with quail and turkey and deer. I mean, it applies to all of it. So, and the other thing is, it's an easy sell when you talk about it in this nature, like an ecological nature. You can get a lot of different people on board, from Audubon to people who like to hike and ride mountain bikes through the woods. I don't know about the whole mountain. Now, that e-bike you got is pretty neat, but I don't want to pedal these mountains over here. I can tell you that right now. But you know, there's a lot of people that could rally around the right mission. And I think we as hunters, you know, we like to pound our chest and say we're conservationists. Well, we're going to have to get a little bit smarter and a little bit wiser about how we share our message and the intent. What is our why? You know, why are we doing this? Why are we doing it? And I think that's going to be important.
That's right. And you're right. You know, and I'll take it a step further. I don't need, you know, there's no doubt that the war against the turkey decline has to be won on private property. And I'll go a step further and say in private timber. Private timber management is where we will win the war or lose the war against the turkey decline. You know, chances are, you know, all the property I've looked at, I've never seen perfect habitat on a piece of property. I've never seen a completed restoration project. I've seen some people burn. I've seen some people thin, but there's always more that can be done. So for the people that's out there listening, 90%, 95, 99% of the habitat across most of the Eastern Turkey's range is horrible and needs something done. And if you don't, you know, if you don't take anything else from this podcast today, I think our message is learn what you can learn and just do it.
Yep.
Just get out there and do it. Even if your time, your money, your resources, whatever, even if the stars don't align just right to do it perfect, just jump in there and think of ways to get through it anyway. And we've got to make a difference. And, you know, keep this in mind. You don't have, if your whole property, the habitat on your whole property sucks, you don't have to make it perfect tomorrow. You can do so. This isn't doesn't have to be such a long-term deal. You can do work tomorrow and see results this spring, see Absolutely. Results from it this summer. And it doesn't have to be perfect this year, but if you just make it better than your neighbors, you're going to have more turkey, more quail, bigger bucks than what they have. So that's what I would love to see. I would love to see a contest maybe we call it keeping up with the Joneses, but everybody trying to make their property better than their neighbors across all of the Eastern Wild Turkeys range.
Sell your bush hog.
Sell your bush hog and start making brood habitat. If you want to know what brood habitat is, tune in to Land and Legacy. There's going to be posting pictures. They just done a podcast. One of the recent podcasts is about creating brood habitat. Look at anything by Dr. Craig Harper, Dr. Marcus Lashley, Dr. Will Goolsby. There are several others that can help you with great habitat. If the person you're following is just a deer guy, he's probably not going to be very good at creating habitat for your deer and turkey, but find someone that takes a holistic approach and learn what you can learn and just do it.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well,
I think that we'll just leave it at that for this week. We got some big things in the works, some things we're talking about and hope to see through. We got some people we're going to interview here in the future. So we appreciate y'all for tuning in and stay with us. We'll see you next week on Sawdust and Fire.